I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Maybe it was the images of children held in cages, or the sounds of youngsters whimpering and crying for their parents, or the condemnation from the Pope and all the living first ladies, or the outrage from the public, or the news of tender age shelters for babies and toddlers. Who knows? But yesterday, President Trump signed an executive order reversing his own policy of separating children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. The executive order says the administration will, quote, maintain family unity, including by detaining alien families together where appropriate and consistent with law and available resources. It goes on to say it's unfortunate that Congress's failure to act and court orders have put the administration in the position of separating alien families to effectively enforce the law. That last sentence is incorrect. The law never called for separating families entering the country illegally. The administration made contradictory statements about the policy announced in April, and this new order raises a whole set of new questions about where these 2,300 children who have been separated from their parents are, and will they be reunited? We have three guests who have joined us this hour of Radio Times. Sabrina Vavuyas is a freelance journalist and writer whose work has appeared in The Guardian U.S., Public Radio International, Philly.com, Philadelphia Weekly, and more. Sabrina, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
I should say have you back with us on Radio Times. Anil Kalhan is Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio as well. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us from the studios of The Atlantic is Adam Serwer, Senior Editor at The Atlantic. And Adam, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I just feel we need to take a moment and just talk about how we're feeling. I'm furious, to put it mildly. Anil, what are your thoughts this morning? Obviously, this was a changed policy yesterday, but nonetheless, we saw children being used as hostages, crying, whimpering, wondering where their parents are. What are your thoughts this morning?
It's been really quite a remarkable spectacle and shocking. I mean, really quite shocking. I think you're right. And it's striking that the administration felt the need to create an impression that they were backtracking so suddenly, so precipitously. I think that the executive order that's been issued raises a whole host of questions and a lot of concerns. And, you know, I don't think that the takeaway for the public and people who've been agitated by this should certainly be that the agitation has had some effect, but not that somehow some definitive result has been achieved.
And I do want to pick up on that. I'm just giving you each a chance to say something. Adam, your thoughts this morning?
I think it's not entirely clear what the consequences of the president's executive order are. What is clear is that the government doesn't seem to have decided to make any special effort to reunite the families that it's split up, which I think is obviously a big problem. But I also think that to the extent that the executive order simply leads to a large population of family prisons to replace the toddler prisons that the government has been running, I'm not sure that a lot of people will view that as a significant improvement.
And again, I'll pick up on that. Sabrina, let me give you a chance to weigh in as well. Your thoughts?
Like you, I'm furious about it. Children are essentially threatened. This isn't the first time. This is just the most obvious time. It's one of the ways that people in family detention are controlled. If they do, or if they complain, if they refuse to do, their children will be taken away. It's one of the things that happens in terms of raids and deportation. A child will come home from school and parents are gone. There's that sort of holding children hostage is not new, but it's extraordinarily, exaggerated by the fact that here are whole hosts of children from, pre-toddler age, very visibly being separated.
I'll pick up on that as well. Let me go back to you, Adam. You wrote a piece in The Atlantic about, and it answers the question, and I've heard a lot of people say this in the last week or so, this is not America. We do not do this to children. Your piece is an answer to that, saying, yes, we do. We have a history of doing this to children. Is it possible to encapsulate that into an answer?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, something that I wrote was that, you know, this sort of disparate treatment, particularly of children of color, is both antithetical to the American creed, but inseparable from its execution, which is that the United States has an ideal that it often doesn't live up to. And one of those ideals is its treatment of people who are, you know, people who are different. And I think if you look at the history from chattel slavery to Indian schools where American Indian children were forced away from their families into boarding schools, or you look at convict leasing where black children after slavery were forced into a kind of neo-slavery through the convict leasing system, we just really have a history of treating the families of people of color as though they're not real families.
Well, even in the 1930s, Jewish children were turned away from our borders. They were escaping Hitler and Nazism.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of moments in history that you can point to where America has not lived up to its highest ideals.
Let me turn
and
to
I think,
yeah, no, go ahead.
You know,
go ahead.
The question is, you know, to what extent now is this something that we're doing on purpose with, you know, the wisdom of history before us?
Anil, is this a wake up call for America?
I mean, I think it should be the latest in a series of wake up calls going back, you know, as this campaign and presidency have unfolded. You know, there's a very strong continuity between what we have seen over the last month with what was said by candidate Trump on the campaign trail, what has been, you know, excuses have been made for a lot of what this administration has done along the way. The difference here is that this has been more visible than some of what has transpired. I mean, there have been a few things that have been very visible ways in which the government has overtly mistreated non-citizens and particularly non-citizens of color over the last year and a half. There have been a lot of things that have been happening, you know, less visibly. I suspect that the administration may have thought that that would be true of the family separations as well. And my guess is they probably didn't expect that it would unfold the way that it did. But yes, I definitely think it should be the latest wake-up call, certainly.
Sabrina, we were talking about this before going on the air about language. The president talked about infestation. He has called people coming from Central America animals, rapists.
Yeah, it's something that people who defend his statements will always say, oh, this really, you know, you're taking him out of context, or, you know, this only matters to, you know, some elite that's, you know, parsing out every sentence. And in my interviews with undocumented immigrants in the past month, it really has stood out that almost every single one of them, and we're talking double digits, has mentioned that while they have, you know, felt really unwelcome for a while, it has escalated to the point that the language really, they're hearing it repeated, and they've taken that language, and it is really part of their understanding of how America works is that language. So it's simply not an elitist concern. This is, you know, a reality.
Mm. And Adam, is there a history there of some of this language?
Yeah, I mean, I think the language sets the stage for the policy. Referring, you know, Donald Trump began his campaign saying that Mexico was sending murderers and rapists and drug dealers to the United States. And once you lay that rhetorical groundwork, you can then treat any immigrant as though they are a potential murderer, drug dealer, rapist. And I want to talk about that particular for a second
sure.
to talk about how that works out in policy. The administration has imposed a zero tolerance policy that says, you know, even though illegal entry is a misdemeanor, we're going to prosecute everyone for it. So what that means in practice is that you're prosecuting normal, regular people and not people who are really dangerous. And the reason why you would do that is because if you just prosecute drug dealers or criminals or murderers or gang members or whatever, then you're not actually dissuading the large amount of people who want to come here and try to find a better life. What the administration wants to do, and in the president's own words, he sees immigration as an infestation that's changing the nature of the country. If you want to dissuade the regular people, the people who aren't actually a public danger, you need to start treating them like criminals, not just the people who might actually pose a danger to public safety.
Let me go back to you, Anil. And what was changed yesterday with the president's executive order?
So it's not entirely clear, as Adam said, how this will actually play out. On its face, what this executive order purports to do or has been characterized as doing is ending the practice of separating children from their parents while the parents are charged as either removable or with a criminal violation of the immigration law, which, as Adam mentioned, is a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. And instead, they will be held together in family detention by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Now, the challenge that they have, and they clearly recognize this, is that what they have proposed violates an existing court agreement, a longstanding settlement in the Flores case, which has, you know, since 2015, it's been clear as that interpretation settlement has been interpreted that minors cannot be held in ICE detention. The settlement provides that minors have to be held under, first of all, there's a presumption of release to their parents or to others. There's a list of different people to whom they could be released, and that is the preferred option. Mm-hmm. Or if they are going to be held in custody, they have to be held in minimally restrictive circumstances by a licensed facility, the licensed under state law, that can provide the dependent care services that are required. And currently there are only a couple.
And how many of those exist?
There are only three. There's one, of course, in Berks County.
Pennsylvania.
Correct. And then there are two in Texas, one in Dilley and one in Karnes, Texas. And what the executive order proposes is a much larger kind of scheme. We're using military bases and other kinds of federal facilities under the custody of ICE, which would not satisfy the requirements of this consent decree.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain. Let me just reintroduce our guests and get back to our conversation. We've got a lot of people that want to join us as well. Sabrina Vivuyas is a freelance journalist and writer. Her work has appeared in The Guardian, on Public Radio International, Philly.com, Philadelphia Weekly, and more. Anil Kalhan is Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. He's also Chair of the New York City Bar Association's International Human Rights Committee. Adam Serwer is Senior Editor at The Atlantic. Anil, right before the break, you were talking about the fact that if we're going to keep families together, that raises a whole host of legal questions and, I'm assuming, problems, but also, where do you put these people? Where do you put families? And you mentioned military bases.
Yeah, so the executive order does propose that in the short term, a variety of different options could be explored for the expansion of an already large detention system, including military facilities that might be have excess capacity or other kinds of federal facilities. I mean, I think the problem is that none of these facilities will in fact be compliant with the Flores requirements to how for the circumstances in which minors are held. And the executive order itself directs the attorney general because of this to go to court and try and get that settlement agreement. The requirements changed so that they can hold minors in more restrictive kinds of custody situations, which, you know, could have very significant negative consequences
for those
kids.
Even if they're with their parents.
Even if they're with their parents.
And there's a 20-day limit now,
right? There's currently a 20-day limit. So I think in practice, we're probably not going to see that happen unless the administration chooses to just violate the terms of the agreement and then get sued. I think it seems, at least the early indications seem like what is more likely to happen is that they're going to comply with the existing court orders and then go and try and litigate against that. And if at that point they could revert to what they've been doing for the last month if they chose to and then just sort of blame the court or blame Congress for not giving them other tools. But the fundamental problem here or the fundamental source of this, which I think has become more clear in public discussions, is not the courts. It's not Congress. It's not the Obama administration. It's that this administration is choosing to criminally prosecute every individual who is crossing outside of a port of entry, even though they're blocking the ports of entry themselves. So people don't and that is a choice that they are making. They're also choosing at that point to detain the parents.
Mm-hmm.
There's no need to – it's not a requirement that somebody who's criminally charged has to be in detention. Take, for example, Paul Manafort, right? He's been out of detention. Now he's in detention, but he was in detention for a long time if you need a high-profile example. But so the source of the – this is a self-created situation by this administration.
Let me go to you, Sabrina, and then Adam, I want to go to you as well. The other family facility, detention facility, there are two in Texas. There's one in Pennsylvania. It's called Berks.
Right.
You've been there.
I have been in contact with the Berks mothers and at one point with some of the teenage children who...
Can you get in? Is the public, are journalists allowed inside?
No. Well, you have to arrange it, and then it's a very sort of determined tour. And there have been several news organizations, TV stations that have been in on tour, but no, you're not allowed in. And the situation there, what the officials say is happening there versus what the mothers and the children say is happening there are radically different narratives.
It's really hard to know what's going on when you can't get journalists inside or even legislators inside as well. Adam, I want to play a montage we put together and give you a chance to respond to it. This is Chief of Staff John Kelly, President Trump, Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders issuing contradictory statements about the child separation policy.
I am considering, in order to deter more movement along this terribly dangerous network, I am considering exactly that. They will be well cared for as we deal with their parents.
The Democrats forced that law upon our nation. I hate it. I hate to see separation of parents and children.
When you prosecute the parents for coming in illegally, which should happen, you have to take the children away.
This administration did not create a policy of separating families at the border.
If you're smuggling a child, then we're going to prosecute you. And that child will be separated from you, probably, as required by law.
We don't want this to be a problem. The president has tried to address it a number of occasions. We've laid out a proposal, and Democrats simply refuse to do their job and fix the problem.
Adam, is that part of the problem, is you've got all these contradictory voices and opinions coming out of the administration?
I don't know that it's part of the problem. I mean, the administration is being... blatantly dishonest about their own policy. They chose to do this. They've defended it and said that it doesn't exist. And they made a choice. They made a choice to adopt a policy of systemic child abuse in order to scare people out of coming to the United States. That was their decision. And they made that decision because they don't want these people to come here. And they found it uncomfortable to defend that because it sounds monstrous. So rather than defend it, they've obfuscated a lot about the reasons why they're doing it. But that's the reason why they're doing it.
Adam, we did numbers of shows when Obama was president, and he was called the deporter in chief. He deported a lot of people out of the United States.
Obama deported a lot of people out of the United States. You know, Obama's defenders would say that he was trying to create space for a deal with the Republicans, but that deal never materialized. But, you know, the difference between Obama and Trump was that Obama supported granting a path to citizenship for the 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States. The Trump administration not only does not support that, but wants to make sure that no further immigrants come here and views them as an infestation. Now, that's the language you know, what do you do with an infestation? You exterminate it. So that's, you know, for one thing, that's very dangerous language. But for another, there's a racial concept of citizenship inherent in the Trump administration's immigration policy that is not present in the Obama administration's immigration policy, as strict as it was. You know, so we're dealing – it's not apples and oranges, and the Obama administration – in its strict enforcement, certainly laid a path for the Trump administration. But what we're dealing with here is a policy that is different in degree and different in conception and nature.
Let me read some comments here. And Anil, I have one for you. As bad as separating families is, this immigration situation has to be stopped. If we relax the rules, the flow of immigrants will increase. Now, there are a couple of bills that look like they could be debated, maybe even voted on today in Congress. And this is an issue that has dogged other presidents about how to create a humane immigration system, but that also addresses the fact that people do sneak into the country. They are here undocumented. Is it possible to create a system that can address all those concerns?
That is a policy challenge, dealing with how you balance all the competing interests in having an immigration system that allows people to come and is orderly and well-regulated. There's no question about that. I don't know that, you know, the montage you played, one piece of it was a suggestion that this draconian enforcement will operate as a deterrent. Now, there's real questions as to whether it's lawful to do that. But I think there's also a real question as to whether that's actually something that would work. You know, the journeys that people undertake, and particularly from Central America, particularly with their children, are really, really wrenching journeys. The deterrent is the fact that it's a wrenching journey, and that people are fleeing real harms. And we do have legal obligations not to return people to those harms under international law, under domestic law, right? We have long been a leader in refugee protection, and you know, at this point, I think it's we are the ones, in fact, actually should be raising questions as to whether we are complying with our own legal obligations.
And these are people coming to the United States seeking asylum.
Yeah.
You want to say something, Sabrina?
Yeah. Well, we're changing how we determine asylum. Not only are we blocking people from ports of entry, we're putting them into detention and getting them out before they even have credible fear interviews. And then we Sessions has made it clear that domestic violence no longer is to be considered, and gang affiliation, which in the Trump administration is defined in the most broad terms possible, so that even those who have been persecuted by gangs have some gang affiliation, are also no longer a basis for granting asylum. Mm. Historically, asylum from Central America has been very low rates. From Mexico, even lower. But this is absolutely targeted.
And can I just add that the rhetoric around this administration's immigration policies has been one of, you know, characterizing immigration flows as out of control. And, you know, we have this massive, you know, growing undocumented problem and borders are out of control. But that is at odds with fact. The number of undocumented immigrants in the United States has leveled off and been going down for a number of years. The number of apprehensions at the border has been going down as well. So you know, there is a disjunction between the rhetoric that is fueling these policies and the actual realities.
Well, I wonder, too, Adam, if there's a disjunction. The president talks about MS-13, and they seem as if they are a violent and very virulent gang, and he wants them out of the United States. But what we hear from people fleeing from Central America is they are fleeing, if not MS-13, they're fleeing from gangs not unlike what MS-13 does.
Right. I mean, the point of the president talking about MS-13 is to be able to characterize regular people as a threat because they might be MS-13. It's
right.
The same thing he did with the Syrian refugees. They might be terrorists, so we can't take any of them. And, you know, I think something that people need to think about is that this costs money. The United States is spending tax dollars to imprison families, to imprison people who don't pose a threat to public safety, people who are not likely to run and will show up for their immigration hearing when it happens. And when we do that, when we spend resource, when we throw money and attorneys and resources at detaining people who are not a public threat, people who might actually be dangerous aren't really dealt with. So, you know, I think, you know, people really need to ask themselves, does the United States want to spend all this money to punish regular people simply because they were unfortunate and are fleeing difficult or frightening circumstances in their home countries and they're looking to America for a better life? I mean, I think, you know, people should really be asking if that's the kind of thing that they want to spend their tax dollars on.
Well, here's the number to call to answer that question, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I think it must be said, just to underscore what the three of you have said, is that when you look at the crime rate of either people here who are undocumented or legal immigrants, that crime rate, Sabrina, is less than native-born Americans.
It is, and it's completely at odds with the way immigrants have been criminalized. It wasn't always that it wasn't always that we deported people. That substantially, the number increased in the 80s. And it wasn't always that coming back into the United States was a felony. Mm-hmm. We have, by referring to people whose only crime is trying to come back into the States, many of them just to reunite with family members, by referring to them as felons, we have effectively created criminalized language that then changes the way we legislate.
Well, and it is a misdemeanor. I looked up misdemeanors to see, well, what else is a misdemeanor? You know, being drunk and disorderly. I mean, doing, perhaps speeding. I'm not sure. I mean, these are sort of almost everyday crimes that probably some of us have committed in our lives.
Yeah, I mean, the overwhelming majority of immigration violations are not criminal offenses at all. For one thing, I mean, there's a very small range of criminal violations where the choice that the government has available to it is not to deport somebody, but to put them in prison or fine them, you know, as Adam said, expending government resources to a considerable extent. This particular crime that the Attorney General has decided must be subject to zero tolerance is a misdemeanor. The maximum sentence is 6 months in prison or a $250 civil penalty. In practice, those aren't the penalties that people even receive. I mean, you know, it can be days in prison and smaller fines, and in particular because it is expensive to hold somebody for any length of time.
Let me read a bunch of comments here. One from a tweet from Peter. It really feels like the zero tolerance was intended to be inflammatory, to get enough people enraged, frame the issue and blame someone else. It lets them file executive orders fixing the problem that they created, letting them pass legislation with less debate. An email from Stu. Trump could not do these things without the complicity of his own party. An email from Dave. If Trump and Sessions had been in power during the previous high rates of immigration, just think of the Irish potato famine, World Wars One and Two, the European plague, etc., their relatives would not be here, and therefore neither would they. Let me go back to you, Adam. Where do you think this debate is going to go from here? As I mentioned earlier, Congress is going to be debating some immigration bills. Where do we go from here?
I'm not exactly sure where we go from here, but I think that it's relatively clear that the Trump administration views its cruelty towards undocumented immigrants as a political asset, that it will seek to emphasize those policies with its base in hopes that they will turn out for the midterms, and that he will continue to exaggerate the threat posed by organizations like MS-13, who are indeed dangerous but who are not the public safety threat that the president claims they are. I mean, I think yesterday in his speech he was claiming that MS-13 had taken over entire towns in Long Island, which I think is news to Long Island. But I think that the administration sees a political advantage to being cruel. And so there will continue to be an approach to immigration that is as punitive as possible.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Adam Serwer, Anil Kalhan, and Sabrina Vuvuyas. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're talking about the separation policy at the U.S.-Mexico border that was in effect for a couple of months. The president signed an executive order ending that specific policy, although there are many questions that do remain. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, our guests are Adam Serwer, joining us from the studios of The Atlantic, where he is senior editor. Anil Kalhan is associate professor of law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law here in Philadelphia. And Sabrina Vuvuyas is a freelance journalist who writes for a number of publications, and she also is based here in Philadelphia. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me put something out there. I scribbled a note to myself last night as I was putting stuff together. This country has generally prided itself on our ability to welcome, to absorb, to integrate immigrants, and to essentially turn them into Americans, and have done a better job than a lot of countries in Europe. I'm looking at you, Anil, but I want to include all of you. Does what we've been dealing with in the last couple of months, does that put that in jeopardy? That somehow we are not the melting pot immigration-friendly country that we thought we were?
Well, I think it's important to separate the policy discussion and the political discourse from what people's everyday attitudes are. And of course, those are not static things. Right. But, you know, I think it still is the case that when you actually poll people on their attitudes about immigration, they're pretty positive and pro-integration and in line with the values you described. One challenge for people who advocate on behalf of immigrants is that for people who hold those attitudes, it's traditionally not been the highest priority concern for them, whereas people who have negative attitudes about immigration, it's often number one or number two. And there are a whole bunch of other reasons why the political discourse and the policy discourse is skewed in a particular direction, that, and as opposed to reflecting mm-hmm. those kinds of attitudes and beliefs. But, you know, to the extent that a lot of these initiatives are in fact raising the profile of immigration as a concern among people who are pro-immigrant and pro-immigration, that might have a way of ironically pulling in that direction.
Sabrina, you're from Guatemala?
That's where I grew up.
And that's where you grew up? And a number, as we know, a number of these families and individuals coming into the country are from Central America, including Guatemala. How is this playing out in those countries?
It's playing out poorly. You know, I think the U.S. International reputation is taking a lot of hits. And you have to remember that Central America already has a history of U.S. intervention in their governments and in different at different points in their history. So while I don't think that Jimmy Morales, who is the president of Guatemala, has, you know, he seems to be perfectly okay, has not done any official denunciation of Trump, the majority of people that I follow and hear from are absolutely appalled and convinced that this is absolutely racist and targeted to indigenous and Latin American folks.
And people of color, I guess we can say.
Absolutely.
Well, Adam, let me go back to you. And the article that you wrote that was one of the reasons we wanted you on, called Trumpism Realized. Are we dealing with Trumpism, and how do you define it?
I define Trumpism as an ideology of cruelty and denial. Cruelty towards outsiders and denial that cruelty is taking place. And I think both of those aspects are important because the denial is what allows the cruelty to proceed. If you tell yourself that it's not really happening or that it's not a form of discrimination, then it's easier to alleviate your conscience and you can sleep better at night. But I want to go back a little bit. I think public opinion on immigration is a little misleading in the United States. I think Americans really like the narrative that we're a melting pot. We're made up of all kinds of different people. We accept anybody. Anybody can be an American. But I think in practice, that's not really true. And when you look at the social science, white Americans in particular have a very skewed perception of immigration. They think immigrants are far more likely to cause crime when they're actually far less likely. They think that immigration is a economic loss for the country, even though it's an economic gain, and they also have a perception that the country is being swamped with immigrants, which, as was pointed out earlier, is not true. And that those perceptions, those skewed perceptions of immigration, have been driving the defection of white voters to the Democratic Party for years now. And I think, you know, if people are asked, there's a thing called social desirability bias, where people give the answer that they think they're supposed to give rather than the one that they really want. Or the one that they really feel. And I think when it comes to immigration, the positive numbers have been skewed for a long time by people who are saying what they think the survey person wants to hear. When in fact, if you look at people's political behavior, it's really the opposite. If people really felt that positively about immigration, then, you know, Donald Trump's candidacy never would have been viable. And I think, you know, to a certain extent, his election is really a wake-up call about how people really feel regardless of, you know, what they tell pollsters.
Is this racism, Adam?
I think to a large extent it is racism.
Do you, Anil?
I think if you look at – particularly if you look at the earlier wave of migration that characterized by immigrants from Eastern and Western Europe that made up, you know, a large section of the United States population. This occurred under legal standards that today would seem incredibly lax, to the extent that immigration restrictions as we understand them simply did not exist when the vast majority of Italians and Eastern Europeans came here. But when we look at these this entire deportation law enforcement apparatus was built essentially when immigrants to the United States began to look less like the population of the inhabitants who founded the country.
The Chinese, Eastern Europe, this was about 100 years ago when a lot of these laws were put in place. Anil, do you want to say anything in response to what Adam said?
No, I think there's a lot to what Adam is saying. I agree with with what he said. Yeah.
Let me get Adrian from Elkins Park to join us on Radio Times. Adrian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I had a question relating to something that was said earlier about the fact that we cannot get access to these detention centers very easily.
Right.
It sounds terribly to me like the imposition of a police state. These are U.S. people's tax dollars that are being spent at these centers, and people are not a threat to national security, and I see no reason why it is that restrictions of congresspeople or the press are enforced by this administration. And I'd like to hear the panel's view on that.
Sure, me too. Adrian, thanks for calling in. Anil, can I toss it back to you? But I'm sure all three of you might have a thought. Why can't people, journalists, legislators in particular, get inside?
I mean, this is a longstanding American approach to not just immigration detention centers, but prisons and jails in terms of just, you know, cloaking them with making them invisible to the public. I mean, you think about sort of where prisons and detention facilities are located. They're located typically in, you know, remote locations far from, you know, that are physically inaccessible. There's a lot of reasons for that. But one significant consequence is to limit access. And policy-wise, I think there's a strong, strong impulse to keep the public away and journalists away from seeing what actually happens when we incarcerate people.
Because these are detention centers.
And prisons. But, you know, that's not there's nothing sort of determined about that. I mean, you could have policies that were more gave more access. The lack of access to prisons and detention facilities does have the effect of insulating what happens in terms of both whether people are detained in the first place and why they are in the circumstances from public discussion. I mean, it does serve that interest.
Sabrina, I want to get back to those 2,300 children.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where they are. We know where some of them are, but we don't know where they all are. It doesn't appear as if the administration has any plan in place to try to reconnect them. And as we were talking earlier, Anil, you were saying that this new policy from the Trump administration doesn't apply to those children and those families. What can be done here? Do you know?
I don't. I think that it's a matter of really grave concern. We know there was a recent ACLU report about the terrible abuses that have taken place in detention centers. And it's not the first. Years ago, there was one from Human Rights Watch about Burke specifically. We know people have had all sorts of terrible institutional experiences in these places. There have been concerns, and that's if the children make it into detention, because there have been times in which children that were presumably, released have found their way to work at farms. You know, suddenly we've got minors working at farms, essentially as indentured, indentured servitude. There are a number of questions about this separation that is not, that haven't been answered, haven't been adequately even looked at. And we're also hearing that ICE is destroying records, is shredding records of abuses and of things. So these children may, in fact, be lost to us forever.
Heartbreaking. An email from Stephen. Any child who's been separated from his or her parent by the U.S. government and cannot be reunited with their parent should immediately be granted U.S. citizenship. That's a thought from one of our listeners. A tweet. I'd love to hear your guest perspective on some other countries' immigration policies, how easily they accept legal immigrants and how they deal with how they accept legal immigrants and how they deal with illegal immigrants. We touched on this earlier, Adam, but is there a model somewhere that would address what we're dealing with in the United States?
I mean, I don't think that it's necessary to look elsewhere in order to have a humane immigration policy. The United States has been around for a couple of centuries now. Mm-hmm. We can decide for ourselves, how to deal with people without treating them like objects. But, you know, that first has to start with, you know, an administration that recognizes that these people are human beings who need to be treated like human beings.
And have a Congress, Anil, that's willing to address, you know, wrestle this immigration issue to the ground and try to figure out a humane policy out of that.
Yeah, I mean, the discussions in Congress right now seem very far from that. I mean, there are two bills being considered in the House today. One is being referred to as a compromise bill, but I mean, that's, you know, the way in which we even talk about some of what's happening and report on these policy discussions is itself, you know, reinforcing, you know, the very lack of humanity in some of these policies.
Making it harder and harder to find some kind of compromise. Well, I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me get Darian from Dover, Delaware, to join our conversation. And Darian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. I would just like to say, as a black man living in America who served this country in a combat capacity, I'm absolutely horrified what we're doing to these children. And I'm even more horrified that there are people out there who support this and who are enjoying this. Each day, I hope and I pray that come November, we can take the house back, because this isn't the America I know. America has never been perfect, but we are psychologically and spiritually scarring these children for life. And this is what they want. That's all I have to say. Thank you very much for taking my question or my statement.
Absolutely, Darian. I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. Adam, not to put a political hue onto our conversation, but is it about the fall election?
Is what about the fall election?
What kind of country we're going to be?
I think that's sort of the question that the country asks itself every election.
Right.
But to the extent that the midterms are a referendum on the Trump administration and its policies, I mean, I think that's absolutely the case. It's the case every time there's a midterm in the president's first term. And I think that, you know, we're going to see to what extent the country is willing to sustain this kind of cruelty.
Well, and there are even members that you hear on TV, Anil, who say that some of these children are actors, that what we're seeing isn't really happening.
I mean, it's just, I don't even know what to say.
It's in Alex Jones territory.
Yeah, and, you know, that's the rhetoric that comes from the administration is not, and from the president, is not always that far from that. I mean, we don't have to go and look to commentators on TV.
I'm sorry. I just want to say one second. They said the same thing about the Little Rock Nine. This idea that the whole thing is manufactured is very much a part of American discourse over racism, where people see things that they're ashamed of. They want to pretend like it was completely fabricated so they don't have to feel bad.
And I just want to insert, as a mother, no 2-year-old can be coached to do what you want them to do
right.
at any moment.
Yes.
So the idea is preposterous.
Well, on that note, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Adam Serwer, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
And the senior editor at The Atlantic, Anil Kahan, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. And Sabrina Vavuyas, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's a freelance journalist based here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about the program. You can download the podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Sign up for our newsletter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.